My freshman year of college, I met one of the most influential people in my life, Sister Maura, a Franciscan Sister of the Eucharist who was the director of our campus ministry. She was tall. Up until then, I didn't think you could be a religious sister if you were taller than 5'3", but there she was, all 6 feet of her, in her brown habit and black veil. She had this effervescence, this joy that poured out of her and affected everyone around her. I've come to learn that that's Jesus' love permeating through her. I like to think that religious are granted one superpower, some preternatural gift that helps them accomplish whatever the vocation is. Things like not needing to sleep that much, infinite patience, perpetually warm feet for the discalced. Well, hers was a wink, and with it, she can get anybody to do anything she wanted. It worked like this. She would say, "Darnell, I need a couple of volunteers to lead this year's wilderness retreat. It's during fall break and I already booked the spots at Inks Lake. Can you help?" And then she would wink. Then what would happen is that despite the fact that I had all of my midterms and two papers due in the days directly preceding or proceeding that retreat, I knew the only correct answer was yes. And it wasn't just me. I saw it work with other students and staff members, people from the community, even a downtown Portland monorail conductor who reopened the monorail for a group of college students from Texas, yes, me amongst them, just so we can get a nice scenic view of Portland. All with a wink. Before she joined the Franciscans, Sister Maura was an artist, a sculptor to be precise. That sensibility never left her. It influenced everything. The projects we took on, the activities in our retreats, the ways she saw and experienced God. And that resonated with me because I had never met someone whose understanding and experience of God was primarily through artistic expression. Back then, I didn't know who I wanted to be. I had rough ideas surrounding photography and video, but the more time I spent with Sister Maura, the more I aspired towards art. And she nurtured that, encouraged me to continue practicing, and taught me how to recognize God the Creator in everything. It fundamentally changed the way I understood my relationship with God, and is definitely part of the reason I still have my faith. Now, more than 10 years removed from college, fully immersed in this venture that is Max Studios, I make a living from artistic pursuits. The photo and video stuff I was unsure how to use back then are the vehicle for continually learning and growing closer to God, and her influence is everywhere. It's funny, Sister Maura's time on campus mirrored my time exactly. She started at UST my freshman year and was moved to Belgium right after I graduated. But I can't help but think that maybe, just maybe, God sent her to UST just for me. Welcome back to Protagonists of Change. I'm your host, Darnell Miller. We have a great show lined up for you. Today, we're talking about the religious, brothers and sisters who have devoted their life to the service of God, and how our relationships with them, understanding the unique, intimate relationship with Christ, can help us lay people better invite Christ into our own lives. We talked to August Turek, author of Visit Secrets of the Trappist Monks, about his own experience as a frequent monastic guest at Mepkin Abbey. He explains how the lessons he learned through their simple lifestyle have helped them become a successful entrepreneur and leader. But first, if you want to hear more stories of people living out their faith, creating a positive change in the church and the world around them, make sure you subscribe to Protagonists of Change on Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts. Better yet, follow us at Max Studios UST on Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok to see all our shows and learn alongside us how to better live our faith. Now, let's jump into this interview with August.
Most important thing in my life has always been the search for God. It grabbed me by the throat when I was only 18 or 19 years old, and grabbed me so hard that I actually dropped out of college to go on this spiritual quest, you know, turned my back on the fact that I had it, quote unquote, made in the shade, according to everybody that knew me then. And I turned my back on it all, and I became celibate and, became a carpet installer and just traveled around the country, living out of the back of my truck, looking for people that could teach me stuff about life. And I had this happen to me, actually. A very strange, semi-miraculous thing happened to me. I was with my brother and we were installing carpet. And we went to this big old mansion, and this guy met us at the door. It was late on a November night, and it was the outside of the place needed paint and everything. But anyway, this guy met us, the owner of the house, and he was not a very nice guy. And he was just, you know, I could just see he just wasn't a very nice guy. But he was very proud of himself and telling us about how much money he made. He had a Mercedes and had this big house, and he'd been very successful in business. And the house didn't have any furniture in it because they hadn't moved in yet. And so my brother is putting down the padding, and I'm coming behind installing the carpet, and I come to this big library. Now, the books had already been brought in, and the books were already in the and I started looking at all the books. And my God, all these books, and they were all religious, and most of them were mysticism books, you know, St. John of the Cross and St. Denis of Areopagite and Eastern religion, mystical writings and all that. I said, whoa. And I pulled this one book out, and it was called Isis Unveiled. It was this book by this Madame Blavatsky that I'd heard about somewhere. And I started reading this book aloud to myself, you know, very softly, kind of fooling around as if I was reading the Book of Life or something. It was this big old tome. I have it over there. And suddenly I hear this voice right at my ear say, are you interested in the spirit of God in man? And I whirl around, here's this guy, the same guy, but his face is completely changed. He's no longer this smarmy jerk that I had met at the door, so proud of himself. And I said, yeah. And I was embarrassed because I was going through his books, and I'm standing there holding one of his books. And I said, are you? And he said, yes, when I was your age, it was the most important thing in my life. He said, but then something happened. He said, I got married and I had kids and I got busy, and there was, you know, dry cleaning tickets, you know, dinner and plans for dinner. And somehow or another, I lost my way. And he said, now I'm 60 years old and it's too late for me. It's too late for me. And tears just started pouring down his face, you know? And suddenly he realized he's standing in front of the carpet installer crying like a baby. And he just suddenly got flushed real red. He whirled around, he leaves. And so I finish up the work, and I don't see him again. And then all of a sudden at the end, I gotta go find him. He's gotta check the work. He's gotta sign the work order. My brother's loading the truck, and I'm loading it, getting ready to follow him into the truck. And the guy taps, I feel a tap on my shoulder, and there's the man again. And his face has changed again. He's got the book in his hand, and he reaches out, he says, here, take this. And I reach out to grab hold of the book, and he doesn't let go of it. He pulls me close to him and he says, yes, take it. I want you to have it. But promise me something. Promise me you'll never forget. Promise me you'll never make the mistake that I made. Promise me you'll never forget. And I just kind of nodded at him. He let go of the book. And next thing I know, I was in the car, and I was, you know, again, I was terrified. I was scared. What the hell was this? Who was this man, you know? And he extracted this promise from me. And then about 3 weeks later, my brother and I are across town, and we're working in an apartment, and the door opens and the man walks in. It was obvious he was the landlord. He owned this building. He starts getting into this conversation with his tenants, and it was obvious the tenants didn't like him, and he was back to being a smarmy jerk. And I didn't say anything to him. I'm down on my knees laying the carpet. And when he finished with his, I finally tap on my shoulder, I look around, and he's got his face right down near mine. He said, you know, every person I've ever met who was serious about the work had eyes just like yours. And he walked out, and I never saw that man again.
August's search for God continued, though he eventually left the carpet installation profession to pursue other business ventures.
I was an entrepreneur. I'd started a company in 1993 with a couple of my spiritual buddies, and we were bootstrapping this company without any investors, so we were working very hard. Meanwhile, I was also, I'd started an organization called the Self-Knowledge Symposium that I was running on local college campuses. And I used to chair these meetings. It was a campus club organization. So the kids would form a club and we'd get a room, and I would show up at North Carolina State, University of North Carolina, Duke University, and I would chair these meetings. And we called it the Self-Knowledge Symposium because we wanted to come up with a way of working across religions, with different religions, or even somebody that didn't have any religion. And so the one thing that's common to all religions is the importance of self-knowledge. So we wanted to be able to do exercises and work on self-knowledge So we could move beyond just sitting around and saying, well, we Presbyterians think this, well, we Christian Catholics think this. I want to move beyond discussions into stuff that we could actually do. So I was also doing that. And then what happened was some of my college students at Duke convinced me to go skydiving in 1996. They said, we're going to do this team building exercise and we're going skydiving and we want you to go skydiving with us. And I did. And as I said, in my book, I said I was brave enough to jump out of an airplane, but I wasn't brave enough to tell those kids I was too damn old to be jumping out of airplanes. And so I jumped out of the airplane and I smashed my ankle. I compound fractured the tibia and the fibula. They're sticking out of my skin, and I was rushed to the hospital. And I started having these horrible, horrible panic attacks and deep, deep, deep depression. And I couldn't figure out where it was coming from because it was a broken ankle. It wasn't life-threatening. And then suddenly it hit me. Yes, this isn't life-threatening, but one of these days, the doctor's not going to say, well, you know, we'll have you out of here in a week. One of these days, they're going to say, there's nothing we can do for you. And I suddenly realized that it was death. And I was confronting my mortality for the first time. And that all of this spiritual work that I had thought I'd been doing for the last 20 years or more wasn't worth a damn. And I got it, but I got a telephone call about 4 or 5 months later from one of my college students. And he said, I just want to let you know, his name is Josh. He said, I just want to let you know that that at least one of your students has taken your advice. And I said, what advice? He said, do something meaningful with your summer vacation rather than just chase girls and drink beer. And I said, well, I don't remember saying it, but I've given worse advice. So what are you doing? He said, I'm spending the whole summer at a Trappist monastery in South Carolina called Mepkin Abbey as a monastic guest. And he went on to tell me that monastic guests at Mepkin Abbey actually wear a habit. They live behind the cloister wall. They do everything that the monks do. They get up at 3 a.m. They do the all the liturgy of the hours. They work in the monastic business. They do everything. There's basically, you're a temporary monk. And I suddenly realized there was something about his voice, that he had found something that he had been looking for. He was a senior at that point. And I said in my book, it was like a post-adolescent work in progress had finally found himself. And I just blurted out, I want to come. And he said, when? And I said, now. And then I realized it was Wednesday and I was at work. And I said, no, Friday, this weekend. And he said, okay, let me go ask Brother John. And he came back on the line 10 minutes later and he said, Brother John said, come on down this weekend.
So he packed up his bags and that Friday he made the journey down to Mepkin Abbey, hoping to find relief.
There's a driveway that goes for about a mile. And on each side of this driveway are these ancient, huge live oak trees. They're overarching. They make almost a tunnel overarching, dappling all the pavement in front of me with shadows. And they're all hanging with Spanish moss. It is a breathtakingly beautiful vista that hits you right over the head as soon as you pull into the gate. And the other thing that really struck me was the peace and tranquility and silence. But there is almost a live silence, the poignancy of the silence. So much so that I actually stopped my car and just sat there for a while, just kind of breathing it all in. And so eventually I went to the end and there's a sign there pointing me to the visitor center, and Brother John met me there and he took me to a guest house called St. Benedict's. And that's where I stayed that first weekend that I was there. And then what happened to me was that I went to the my first service, which was Vespers. And the service starts by a monk suddenly sings, Lord, come to our assistance. And then everybody, the rest of the congregation says, Lord, make haste to help me. Then everybody faces and does the glory be to the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. And then the service begins with a hymn, and then there's chanting of the Psalms back and forth. That's the root of all of their services, is chanting the Psalms. So the first verse is done by one side, then the other side answers back and forth. And that very first service I was at, I was just standing there kind of taking it all in. And I remember thinking, you know, I was in very bad shape. I mean, I was not down there on some kind of anthropological mission or out of curiosity or because I was on retreat. I was desperate. I was sinking in the creek bud. I felt myself, I was terrified about what was happening to me. And I was looking. So when they said, come to my assistance, Lord Bay Cape Town, I said, wow, I'm in the right place. And, but at the reading that particular day was, the reading, from Kings where, Elijah is chased out into the desert, because he's denounced, Jezebel, et cetera. And so the angel comes to him and says, what are you doing, Elijah? And he said, I'm trying to keep straight the way of the Lord. He said, and because they're tearing down, his altars, now they're coming to kill me. And the next part of the thing is, I'm sure you're familiar with this part of scripture where suddenly there's a great noise, but the Lord was not in the wind. The Lord was not in. And so Elijah gets up and goes to the door and stands there as God passes by. And suddenly I just came apart at the seams. I started crying and crying and crying, and I couldn't stop. And I was so embarrassed. Here I am at my very first service, surrounded by all these monks. And I was right next to Brother Robert. As a matter of fact, he showed me my seat. And the first thing he ever said to me was, the chapel is open all night. So I ran out of the church trying to get myself together. And I left the monastery proper and went out to the parking lot, and I'm wandering around in the parking lot. And suddenly I see this monk coming down the road to the parking lot about maybe 50 yards away from me. And he's walking very deliberately, not strolling. He's actually marching. And he looks like he's going to be walking past me 50 yards away, when suddenly he makes a hard right angle and he comes walking directly at me. And I'm waiting and toward him. And when he gets there, he had this wild look in his eye, and he had this snow white kind of, his hood was up, his black hood was up, his face was had this snow white kind of look to it, and his eyes were just kind of wild looking, and he seemed to be just. So I just said, well, excuse me, brother. I said, my name's August Turak, and I'm here on retreat for the weekend. And he doesn't answer. And so I repeat myself, and then I repeat myself a third time, and he never answers. He just keeps glaring at me and staring at me, and suddenly he just walks away. And and I said later, later on I found out that it was Father Benjamin, who was an Alzheimer's patient. And he was on pretty much on his last unsupervised walk before being confined completely to the senior center, where he eventually died. Even when I found that out, I couldn't shake the idea that he had been demanding that I answer for myself, that I answer for my life, that the combination of what hit me in the unbelievable beauty of what I wanted so much, what was lost, what I had lost in my own life completely, was the beauty, the wonder, the magic of standing in that door of the cave as God passes by. Imagine what that must be like.
I mean, that sounds like a borderline terrifying experience, if I'm being quite honest.
It was. My whole 2-year experience of my dark night of the soul was full of incredible, a quasi or even literally supernatural things. And they were all terrifying. But if you go back into the Bible, my friend, show me one supernatural thing that isn't terrifying. When Isaiah in chapter 6 is in the temple, and all of a sudden he hears, holy, holy, holy. What's the first thing he says? Hey, glad to see you, Lord. Wow, I've been waiting around for you. He falls on his knees and he screams, I'm doomed. I'm doomed. I'm impure. I am impure. And the angel puts the coal to his lips and purifies him with the burning coal so that he can live. When the burning bush talks to Moses, what does he say? Wow, this is wonderful. Oh, God, I've always wondered what it'd be like for a bush to start talking to me. He's absolutely terrified. What is the first thing the angel has to say to the Virgin Mary? What's the first thing he says to her? Be not afraid. She's terrified. all close encounters of the first kind, which are close encounters with the Lord, are going to be initially terrifying, because the first thing you're aware of is your unworthiness. And it's not like an intellectual thing. I'm kind of scared here. I wonder why. Oh, I guess it's because I'm unworthy. No, it's existential. It's this horror. It's this feeling of how unworthy you are. In a Catholic sense, how sinful you are.
Still, that starting encounter wasn't enough to deter August, and he stayed, experiencing the flow of Trappist's daily life, getting lost in its rhythm.
You get up at 3 o'clock in the morning for vigils. The vigil starts at 3:20. You go from 3:20 to 4 o'clock doing vigils. As soon as vigils is over, there's 30 minutes of meditation, and then afterwards that you're supposed to be doing Lectio Divina, which is meditation based on the Bible, until the next service is Lauds. And as soon as Lauds is over, then you have breakfast. Then you go to Mass. And then when Mass is over, you have a couple of minutes of, they call it Thanksgiving, about 10 minutes of Eucharistic Thanksgiving. And then you have Terce, which is a very short service. They have the major services and the minor parts of the Terce and Known, which is right after lunch, and Sext, which is what happens at noon, are three services and are only about 15 minutes long. The other services are 30 to 40 minutes long. And then you go to work. And what I did back then, they now are in the mushroom business, but back then they were in the egg business. So I would get a bicycle out of the garage that they had there with a full of bicycles. And I would jump on a bicycle and I would drive out to the farm and I would go to the eggery, which is where they processed the eggs. And sometimes I would be the loader, which means taking these eggs off of the and putting them onto the conveyor belt to start them down the path to being cleaned and graded and checked for imperfections and all that. But most of the time I would be on the other end, which was the round table. So all these eggs get graded into small, medium, large, extra large, jumbo. And each one of these cartons has a different color, so you know, and then they come spinning off the line onto this great big round table that spins around. And my job would be then to grab them and put the jumbos in a carton where all jumbos go, and the extra larges and all the extra, and the big, and as fast as I could just keep jamming them into these things. And then when they got stacked up so high, then I would push them into the cooler and rush back, because if you're not careful, you end up with eggs all over the floor because they spin around and get too many, you get behind and the too many eggs are spinning. As Father Christian, my spiritual director, used to say, running the round table tends to engender panic. When you first get to the monastery, especially if you're a nasty guest, you bring all of your wares and cares with you. And, you know, so the first few days you're at work, you're still, oh, damn, I should have answered that email before I left town or whatever. But gradually, all that stuff is jammed out of your mind by all of the rituals that you're going through, all of the stuff that's happening in church, and all of the things maybe you're reading, all the things you're meditating about, all the hymns you're singing, you know. And little by little, this becomes, you stop thinking at all about home and about your cares, and you find that you're at work for hours on end, and you're kind of in a meditative state. You know, and then the next thing that happens, because you're thinking about some scriptural reference, or I remember one time I became obsessed with, there was a hymn that we'd sang a couple of times. You'd hear it at Christmas every year. It's called, Save Us, O Lord, Carry Us Back, Turn Your People Around, Rescue Your People, Show Us Your Face, Bring Us Back. And hour after hour after hour, I'd be in that song, and I'd be parsing it. I'd be thinking about every one of those words, and what would it take to turn me around? What would it take to bring me back? What's going to take to bring us back? You know, and then the next thing that happens is that your whole sense of time becomes distorted, because everything is quote unquote intentionally monotonous. Every day is exactly like every other day, and it's done intentionally that way. And there's a little bit of variation only because on Sundays you don't work, or holy days you don't work. But besides that, everything is exactly the same every single day. And so what happens is time, first of all, the thing that I would find that the monastic routine would kind of lift me up and carry me. And then he would lose track of time, and you'd be thinking about some scriptural reference at work, and you'd say, was that this morning at vigils that I heard that? Or was it yesterday at Lod's? Or was it last week? And I remember this really coming, hitting me in a funny way when I asked Brother Robert one time, I said, how long has Father Anthony been dead? And he said, 5 or 6 years. And I said, that's impossible, Brother Robert. I said, I've only been coming to Mepkin for 3 years. And he was alive when I first got here. He was in a wheelchair, but he was alive when I first got here. And he said, oh, well, he said 5 years, 10 years, 100 years, eternity. What difference? There's no time here. We're Trappists. The other side of the equation is the confrontational aspect. There was a monk that came. He was an executive at Columbia University, and he decided to become a monk, and he joined the monastery. And the first time I met him, he came to work, and we knew who each other were, but we introduced ourselves to ourselves. And I said, how's it going so far? And he said, it's hard, and hard in ways that I never would have imagined. And I said, for instance, and he went like this. He said, I'm right here all the time. He put his hand right in front of his face and said, like a mirror, I'm right here all the time. He said, I thought I was bringing leaving my demons behind, but I guess I brought them all along with you. There's no place to run and there's no place to hide at the monastery. There was an article in the wall on Time Magazine, New York Times, about the monastery, and people were being interviewed, guests were being interviewed, and they said how peaceful it was, and how tranquil it was, and how beautiful it was. And this guy finally says, this businessman says, yeah, it's all that's true. It's beautiful and it's tranquil. But let me tell you something. When you've got nothing else to do but sit on a park bench overlooking the Cooper River for hours on end, you find yourself thinking about a lot of things you might rather not think about. And there's a reason why in our society that if you go to a hockey game or a ball game, as soon as the action starts, the music starts, the jumbotron starts, we have to be distracted all the time. We are never allowed. The worst thing that can happen is for you to just sit in a chair quietly by yourself with your own thoughts. Because the next thing that happens is boredom. And if you sit with boredom for a while and really observe it, you'll realize that there's anxiety underneath boredom. It's anxiety producing to be bored. And then you ask yourself, what's going on with this anxiety? And underneath that, you see there's panic. You start thinking about a lot of things you might rather not think about. Like, hey, am I living the right kind of life? I had my college students one time at Duke. I said, as part of this class, I was teaching this class for credit. And I said, what I want you to do, one of your homework assignment is go to the Duke Chapel and sit for 5 minutes. You don't have to pray. You don't have to do anything. All you have to do is go to the chapel and sit for 5 minutes. And week after week, and I said, only 5 days out of the next 7 days. We only were meeting one, we had one 3 hour class once a week. I said, you only have to do it 5 out of the next 7 days. I don't care what time of day you go, 5 minutes a day, 5 minutes. Week after week, they couldn't do it. So finally this boy says, I don't understand it. I walk past that damn chapel 25,000 times a day. Why can't I go in there and sit for 5 minutes? And this young girl says, I don't know about you, but I know why I can't. And everybody got really quiet. And she was real quiet for a minute. And then she said, I'm afraid that if I go in there and sit, I'll realize I'm wasting my life. And everybody then just sat quietly, and the spirit came into the room, and I let it go for 20, 30 minutes. We just sat there with that thought. And that's what we're terrified of. That's far more terrifying than meeting a crazy monk who's asking you to a conference. That's what that is, because deep down inside, that's what we're all running away from. We all want to stay busy. We all want to stay doing whatever the heck we can so that we don't have to look in that mirror and say, am I wasting my life?
Am I wasting my life? What a heavy question to ponder. But August, in his search for God, in his encounters with the Trappist, learned what was necessary to answer that question with a resounding no.
One of my old teachers from when I was a very young man, I asked him one time, I said, what do you think of prayer? And he said, make your life your prayer and it will be answered instantly. I don't compartmentalize. I mean, there isn't my spiritual world and then this other world and there's the business world. That's what I told you before we started the interview today. I mean, to me, everything I do is part of my spiritual path.
If you've made it this far, thank you for sticking with us. Man, we are called to devote our lives to Christ. Some people are jazzed to do it differently. To all the Brother Johns and Sister Moras out there, thank you for beautifully modeling the faith. And to all you future Brother Johns and Sister Moras, trust. So share this episode with someone who is a religious brother or sister who you look up to. Share it with your family, your friends, your coworkers, classmates, your one friend who should definitely consider the religious life. You know who they are. And a special thank you to August. Thank you for sharing your story. To hear more about his experience, check out his books, Business Secrets of the Trappist Monks and Brother John. I'm Darnell Miller, and you've been listening to Protagonists of Change, a podcast from Max Studios at the University of St. Thomas in Houston, Texas. Until next time, peace.